Thank you very much for joining us in our festival. Of course, when I say our, I mean to say it's your festival as much as mine. It is the festival of all of us. It is the festival based on spirituality. Naturally, when we talk about spirituality, we talk about spirit, we talk about the soul. So this topic, does the soul exist, is an obvious topic in any such festival. There's many things one can say. One can argue for the existence of a soul. One can argue against. Before we do anything like that, I think we should first define what the soul is to some extent. Otherwise, we talk about something ethereal. Basically, the scriptures around the world are in agreement about the nature of the soul, and dictionaries carry the same idea, that the soul is eternal, that the soul is timeless, that the soul is spiritual, that the soul is the spark of life within the body, that the soul is lending consciousness to the living being, that when we are looking at ourselves, that we can see that the soul, being eternal, is now residing within a temporary body, and that, therefore, the soul in that temporary body is the true self, because one day the body will no longer exist, and the soul will still be there. Therefore, if we think about it deeper, it is, from that perspective, the soul would be the real identity. I will not spend time on trying to prove that the soul exists with arguments. And the reason is because it remains very theoretical. I would like to kind of rather scope out the territory a little bit. And what I'm thinking is that when we speak about the soul or the eternity of the living being as a tiny spiritual spark, which is that which gives life, then when we speak about the living being, then we also consider that the living being is part of a spiritual reality. So you cannot just speak of the soul. If the soul existing, obviously, where is the soul existing? And in relation to what is the soul existing? So the soul is existing eternally, and there's also an eternal domain. That eternal domain in Vedic terms is called the spiritual world, Vaikuntha, that place where there is no anxiety, and that is considered the abode of God. So yes, we are looking at that. We're looking at the spiritual reality, we're looking at the eternal spiritual world, where the soul is an eternal resident. So the next question then is, the soul can exist in either this realm, the material realm, or in the spiritual realm. In the material realm, we are experiencing a certain variety of influences in our lives based on happiness and distress. That's the nature of this world, the world of happiness and distress. But we have a deep desire. The Vedic literature says Anandamaya Vyasat, that the soul by nature is pleasure seeking. And therefore our tendency is to enjoy happiness, which we will not get to the extent that we desire it. Thus, the nature of this world. Then, it is said in the spiritual world, though, there is another experience. There one can, due to one's eternal relationship of service to the Supreme Lord, there one experiences great, never-ending happiness. So this is really what is the destiny of the soul. If we're looking at the question, does the soul exist? Then we say that actually in this material realm, the soul doesn't exist in its full glory. In the material realm, what's the situation? Is that the soul is existing in the body in a dormant state. If the soul is at this stage practically not active, it is the mind that takes over the functions of the soul. And thinking, feeling, and willing is now going on by the activity of the mind. On the spiritual level, thinking, feeling, and willing is happening on the platform of the soul. So that is very significant, that here the soul, just as a sleeping person, is only very, for a small percentage, active. Whereas in the spiritual realm, the soul is 100% awake and 100% active, and therefore also 100% alive and 100% happiness. So yes, the soul does exist, and in the material realm, the soul is only functioning on a small percentage of its capacity. And in the spiritual realm, it is actually flourishing in its full capacity. And that's the message of all traditions in the world, of all spiritual traditions in the world, that the soul belongs in that condition of eternity. It may be argued whether the soul exists or not. I guess Plato's answer is a good answer, that if the soul does not exist and there is no life after death, then there's nothing to worry about. If there, however, is, if the soul does exist, and if there is a life after death, then we should do something now to invest in that. So if there's nothing, then nothing to worry about. But if there is something, then better we invest something. So from that logic, Socrates points out it would be wise to invest in this life, in the soul, and in the benefit of the soul. And the question whether the soul exists or not is secondary, because that question will not be resolved. We will argue from either point of view. We will argue. From the Vedic point of view, the Vedas don't ask faith in advance. There are some traditions, they say, first believe, and then, then you can receive the knowledge. The Vedas simply ask to temporarily suspend disbelief. They say, okay, do not exclude it, do not write it off, just for argument's sake, to investigate the system of belief, accept that the soul might exist, and then act accordingly. Well, there is a full picture. There is a picture of a Supreme Lord who has an eternal world where eternal living beings are his associates. Some rebellious living beings desire an existence separate from the Lord, then there is this world. This is the world where we can forget about God. Here he is not necessarily in the center. Here, we can put so many other things in the center, and ultimately, in this world, we can put ourselves in the center. It is said that, of course, is an unnatural state, because by nature, the living being is part and parcel of the Supreme Lord, and is by nature, we are meant to serve. It is said the nature of water is wet, the nature of sugar is sweet. The nature of the living being is to serve. We have to serve. We cannot avoid it. Either we must serve our boss, we must serve the nature, the nation, we must serve our family, we must serve. It is said that, like, at the bottom of the ladder, it is there one has many rights and less responsibility. At the top of the ladder, one has few rights and all responsibility. Some of the management gurus have stated like that. So what shall we say? It is a fact that the more one becomes in charge in this world, the more one is a servant. The president of a nation is a public servant. He has no private life. The more famous one becomes, the more one has to hide. And it's said that once George Harrison was in Paris and the press was banging on the door and they wanted to get in. And finally they broke the door down, and in the room of the hotel there was a hole in the wall, a chute for putting in the laundry, and he dived into the laundry chute to escape, landing on a pile of sheets down in the basement, and then making... So that's the life of a celebrity who is just like the story of Diana, who was just chased by the press. No private life. So, therefore, we cannot escape service. Service is our natural propensity. We can't get around it. But that service can only be fulfilled in the eternal realm. I'm extending the topic a little bit too broad to its parameters, because I feel the question, does the soul exist, is sort of isolated. It's isolated from its context, and it really doesn't it doesn't do it justice, doesn't do the topic justice. So I have to sketch the context. I'm waiting for your questions to come in. I think some are written down. So whenever they come this way, I will start responding to them. And meanwhile, yes. So this festival is a festival which is meant to spiritualize the atmosphere, to remind us of the spiritual aspect of life, to remind us how we are not just independent entities on our own, but how we are part of a greater whole, and how we have a part to play within that whole, and that ultimately the end all of that greater whole is the Supreme Lord and His divine plan. That nothing in this world moves without the prime mover, and that everything has a purpose. And no matter how many arrangements we make, here at the beachfront, many arrangements have been made by men. We also have made an arrangement with many tens. There are walkways, there are piers going out into the ocean, and so on. There are ships. But ultimately, these are small arrangements that man has made upon the bigger arrangements that were already there. An atheist might say the arrangements of nature, and we say the arrangement of the supreme mind. So the soul, the living being, has a part to play within that greater plan. And ultimately, we can glorify something. Yeah? We can all sit in a stadium and watch some sports event and see the power of muscle, and see what amazing things are going on. We can sit here and look at nature and appreciate the beauty of nature and how the endless waves of the ocean are washing in. We can do all that. But ultimately, one who thinks deeper will ask the question, what is the source? What is the source of the strength of those endless waves? Where is that energy coming from? Where is the energy of the sun coming from? Where is the energy of the soul coming from? So at that stage, a person who begins to see like that, an unlimited source of energy, will not find it difficult to look at the Supreme Lord. I begin with your question. What exactly is a spiritual body? That's a good question. It is a fact that in the spiritual world, where the soul eternally exists, there also the soul has a form. Here, within this world, the soul is present within the region of the heart, and is like a very small spark. But in the spiritual world, the soul is manifest in its full glories, in its spiritual body. Here, the body is like a vehicle. In this world, it is said the body is just compared to a car, and we enter into the car. And then, at one point, we get out of the car, end of life. The car remains here, and the passenger moves on. So in this world, there is a distinct difference between the body and the soul. But in the spiritual world, the soul is not separated from the living being. In the spiritual world, the spiritual body is the self. It is not a vehicle in which the self is moving about. It is the self. And the spiritual body is therefore an expression of the nature of the soul. And the spiritual body is therefore not inhibiting. Here, because it is separate from us, it's a vehicle, it has its limitations. Like any car, no matter how good it is, it has limitations. Okay. Any machine in this world, it always falls short. You may have the latest camera, but it's not as good as the eye. You may have the latest computer, but it doesn't completely connect to the brain. And there's always something in between, buttons, and why doesn't the thing work, and it should work, and it doesn't, and it's just too much electronics. Okay? So, because it's a machine and it's separated from us. So the body is also a machine, it's separated from us. It doesn't do what we want. I mean, sometimes it seems to for a moment, and then again, oh no, it's not. And that's why then we go to a doctor. So, but the spiritual body is part of the soul, and therefore it is not limiting the expression of the soul. And the spiritual body is therefore fully blissful. We cannot understand that. Like, I don't know how you feel now, but it is kind of muggy, right? It is that typical 97% humidity that we have in Durban, and you know, where you feel you can cut slices out of the air, thick and heavy and warm and sticky. And what to say, that's the nature of the material world. The body experiences some discomfort. We're used to it, we let it go, we go around it. But therefore, it is very difficult to conceive of a totally blissful body. We can only imagine it, and even then, our imagination falls short. But every experience about the spiritual body is blissful, everything. So it's practically doesn't compare to the material body. The material body is just a pretty poor manifestation compared to the spiritual body. Therefore, we should not wait. We should get serious about returning to the spiritual world and attaining the spiritual body. Once we have been liberated to the spiritual world, do we, the soul, remember our existence in the material world? Do we remember or recognize the families that we had in the material world? Oh yes, yes, we do. We do. Of course, we'll also remember more than we remember now. The Vedic understanding is that the living being is in this material world life after life. And life after life, in many, many births, one has many parents, many brothers, many sisters, and so on. In the Christian tradition, this idea of reincarnation was only canceled or only denied as truth by conclave in the 6th century. So that's a lot late, actually, very late, 600 years, 500 and something years, reincarnation was accepted in Christian doctrine. It was a really long time, actually, and oftentimes, you must say that in the first inaugurational period of a tradition, you expect that the teachings are alive and strong, and that later, with time, they might become covered and altered. So that's a strong point. So reincarnation, whatever may be, the idea is that when the soul gets involved with matter, that one day when the end of life comes, no one says to death, I'm ready now, I've done it all, I'm completely ready. Everyone says, no, just give me a little more time. Just a little more time. Nice. See, that's the idea. The idea is that people from all cultures can be together. Although people from all cultures have many differences, they have different food, different way to speak, different way of doing things. And therefore, people in the world are divided. And apartheid certainly wasn't invented in South Africa, and it's also not the trademark of South Africa. Although South Africa has a history with it that stands out in the world, but it's everywhere. It's in every nook and corner of the world. It's even apparently amongst the animals, because the proverb says, birds of a feather flock together. So what to say? So how can one bring different communities or different kinds of people together? Only by appreciating the soul. Because the soul goes beyond the temporary culture. The soul, basically, we all have taken birth in different positions and so on, but on the platform of the soul, we can rise above these things, and we belong above these things in an eternal reality where, yes, in answer to your question, where we can remember our existence in the material world, but we're not going to say, oh, you know, you were black in the material world, you were white in the material world, you were brown in the material world, you were yellow in the material world, and then we still divide in different corners. On the spiritual platform, these divisions don't exist. On the spiritual platform, we are all liberated from that. There we are one. As it said that, like, if we brotherhood amongst men, you cannot get it by declaration. We can have a big declaration that we are all brothers and so on, but brotherhood cannot be achieved by declaration. Brotherhood can only be realized when we are appreciating the same Father. When we are appreciating the same Father, then brotherhood can be realized. When I focus, you know, brotherhood is coming into existence due to our relationship with the Father. And the common Father. Then, if we have a common Father, then you're my brother. And then, all right, then we, and then for the sake of our Father, I'm tolerating this brother. For the sake of my Father, I'm cooperating with this brother. Right? It is for the sake of the Father that one can unite. That is the key. And that is how this science of the soul can unite. So in the spiritual world, we may recognize the family that we have in the material world, but in the spiritual world, we see that everyone is our family. Where does it stop? Is it only, oh, your child, oh, little darling, so sweet, and then that horrible monster of the neighbors? Is that it? Is that how it is? No. Where does it stop? Where does our family stop? Where does it begin? And that's the question. I mean, we have our immediate family, we have our extended family. If you go a long way, and you can trace out your whole family lineage, I mean, then you get huge, huge family trees. You can see how certain names are like family names, and they're all connected. Like, actually, this one is a cousin of mine. And it is like that. Singing is also a natural quality of the soul. That's why music is very powerful. The last time I flew back from South Africa, there was an African choir on the plane. And at about 5 in the morning, they did a spontaneous concert. It was very beautiful, a really amazing harmony singing, very beautiful. The pilot even came out of the cockpit, and everyone stood there watching it, and everyone was just touched, and the whole plane, big applause, and went on for about, maybe 45 minutes, and it was remarkable, because singing is an expression of, it touches the soul, like that. Especially when we begin to sing the name of the Supreme Lord, then we become really omnipotent. We'll go on to the next. If the soul is dormant, the brain activities help the soul. What happens to the soul if a person is brain dead? If a person is brain dead, then the soul is still there within the body. The soul is still making the heart beat. The soul is still there, but the communication with the brain is what is for some reason blocked. So there's a blockage, a loose connection, or we'll call it whatever you want, but some blockage in the connection, and therefore the normal functioning of consciousness through the brain is no longer possible, and the person is considered brain dead. Of course, there are testimonies that sometimes people appear to perceive more than we think. It seems to be that sometimes even the so-called brain dead people seem to respond a little bit to their environment. So how much a person is really brain dead or not is something difficult to say. And we cannot truly judge that matter. The soul is still present, and then around, basically we look at the situation like this. Think of three concentric circles. The center circle is the soul. The next circle is a subtle body made of mental energy. And the third circle is the gross body. So even when the gross body is not functioning properly, then still the subtle body is working to some extent. And therefore, we hear many accounts of out-of-body experiences during operations or other near-death experiences. And I myself have some experience with that. When once I was injured and unconscious for close to a week, during that week, I remember being out of the body several times. And I remember that I wanted to know where I was. And I decided to go through the wall. And I went through the wall and I came outside. And I recognized the hospital. I recognized the environment. And then, just as I had done my round, I came to the parking lot and I saw a car coming. And I saw that it's a car from our temple. And I saw devotees in there, but they must be coming to visit me, but I'm not home. So I decided that I should go back, and I went back. But then I was unconscious, of course. That part didn't fully compute. But later on, I confirmed that I did recall that they came, and I could say, who was sitting where in the car? What do you say? So such existences where the body is not functional and we have a whole world of experience, that's not imaginary. Many people can testify to such experiences, and I can also. And the interesting of my experience was that indeed I saw the car and I saw the people sitting in their places. And it was correct, right? So it was verified that I was relating to the world. And it's often like that, isn't it? Doctors also say, you know, during operations, patients that are unconscious can repeat parts of the conversations that were going on that they were watching. Yeah. So that is there. So the dormant soul is maybe dormant in the gross body, but maybe still active in the subtle body. Then we have a question here. I'm an uninitiated devotee. I want to get initiated, so I'm working towards it. About the existence of the soul, I believe it is calculated why that it does exist, and that is my opinion. I'm entitled to it. Yes, 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 of course. I mean, there are good arguments for the existence of the soul. After all, we see that that life is there in certain, in living, there's living beings, they have life, and there is other beings that other manifestations of dead matter. Yeah. We see both. And we see that life is growing. We see that life comes and goes, and that there's a transformation from one, at the time when someone leaves the body, then suddenly these bodies are, something has changed. But what has changed? So there are many indications. The point is this. If you're trying to prove the existence of the soul, you will find that you get some arguments for it, some arguments against it, and you may intuitively feel inclined towards one of the two. But we are not suggesting that we bother too much with that question. Yes or no, yes soul, no soul, yes or no soul. Just invest. Invest in spirituality, and the more you do, you undergo a change of perception. And as a person goes deeper into spiritual life, perception changes. And then at one point, the soul becomes very perceivable. Then it's no longer a question. Then it's no longer something based on logic. Then there is direct perception of the soul. And the more one spiritually evolves, the more one has that direct perception of the soul. And that's the essence. What is the relationship between the soul, the mind, and the intellect? As I said, there are three circles. The outer circle is the body. Then the circle within that contains mind, intellect, and also a false identification as matter, as the self, which makes us embodied. And then in the center, the soul. So, mind and intellect belong to the subtle body, and the soul is the driving force of the subtle body as well as the gross body. So in a way, mind and intellect are instruments. They're instruments. Just like muscles, or like the eyes, or like the ears, they're instruments, mind and intellect. And the soul works through these instruments. That's all it is. The Vedic culture has its principles on the Indians, and Krishna is believed mostly by the Indians. Then how can you make people from different races to believe in Krishna? Yes. Well, I also at first thought like that. I thought it's kind of an Indian thing. After all, I'm not from India, you know, I wasn't born in India. I'm from the Netherlands, and it's a very different kind of place. What to say? There is a point where one takes interest in spirit. And that's where it begins. The journey begins there, where we take interest in spirit. Is there more than this temporary material realm? Should I do this? Give me some tea. Is there more than this temporary material realm? So spirit. The search for spirit. When we start to search our spirit, then naturally we get we look at different traditions. We may look at the tradition of our birth, but if we're a little bit broad-minded, we don't stop there. Yeah? We don't necessarily think that that our own country has the monopoly. I remember I was in Denmark and speaking on the main marketplace about about the culture of India. And the first thing that came to my mind was saying that do we really think that in a country of Denmark with 5 million people, that this country has the truth and that the rest of the world got it wrong? Yeah? So is this really what we believe? So that was to open up the minds that we have to look over the border, that there is more than the land of our birth. Do we think that God was so kind to 5 million people in Denmark, right? And that he said to 1 billion people in India, I'm giving you the wrong tradition? Do you think that he said to South Africa, sorry guys, you know, your tradition is wrong? No. It's not like that at all. The deeper we search out in the traditions of the world, the more we find that they are descriptions of the same thing. Then we find that neophytes in spiritual life are very sectarian. They think my way is the only way, is the highway. Those who are more learned, they can see. Those who are more realized can see the common factor in all spiritual traditions. They can see that it's the same, basically. And there are differences, but these differences may be either due to human interpretation, or maybe that preachers or prophets revealed according to time and place, as people were ready. But the differences are not major, actually, if we look deep. So that's one thing one finds. We find that, in 1970, I started traveling around the world looking for spiritual life, and that journey eventually brought me to India. And when I came to India, I investigated the culture of India, and I compared that with the culture of the West, and I found that many deep principles were common. So, what about Krishna? Krishna is the one God, what the Muslims would call Allah. Allah, the word Allah comes from Allah. Allah means there is one God. That's basically what it's trying to establish. One God, which is a big theme in Islam. Well, the Vedic literature says the same. It is said, Ishvara Parama Krishna, Satsidananda Vigraha, Anadiradir Govind Sarva Karana Karanam. It says that the original Supreme Lord is one. He is one. Yes. So, Christianity also establishes there is one God. Even if one looks deeper into African tradition, beyond ancestor worship, if one looks deeper, then one also finds that there is one original Lord. So the same principles are everywhere. So if one can come to that point, then we see all these names. I said Allah means there is one God. So then the name Krishna means all attractive. So names of God, we're talking about the same God who is known by different names, by different people from different cultures. And the principle is that Krishna means all attractive. And that says something about our relationship with the Supreme Lord. And that's the interesting part. It talks about how God has the natural power to attract everyone. And once that sinks in, you know, that's not just a small thing, but once that thing sinks in, then we see that that is the key of our whole life, because our whole life is based on attraction. We're always attracted to this, attracted to that. That is our nature, always attracted to something. But all these attractions are not satisfying fully. You want to be married, and then you're married, and you think, oh, when I, the good old days when I was still free, and all that I could do, you know. And you want to, you're in a university, and you can't wait to graduate, and then you've graduated, and then you work, and you think, oh, the good old days of the university. I mean, so in this world, we are always attracted, but the grass is always greener on the other side. That's the issue. But when we come to Krishna, then that attraction, when we come to God, that attraction becomes focused. And when one really finds God, then no need to go here and there anymore. Then that focus goes deeper and deeper, and that attraction to God will just pull us in more and more. And where it is becoming a full experience of just being attracted by the Supreme Lord. And of course, that exists in other traditions, where people are fully attracted to God exclusively and no more interest in anything else. So Krishna stands for that. So in that way, Krishna is there for everyone. And this whole idea that Krishna belongs to India is just missing the point. God is all attractive. All attractive. He's for all. It's once we become attracted to God, only there will we find a homecoming. Only there will we find peace. What happens when you die without believing in God? Then you will be, you will have invested your whole attention on matter. If you don't believe in God, then you think your happiness will come from matter. And then you have become obsessed by matter. So a person who dies not believing in God believes in matter. And therefore what he gets is matter. And therefore such a person is drawn back to the material world due to his obsession with matter. And then due to being obsessed, he has to again and again enter into all kinds of arrangements in this world. And then there are two things. One is his desire, and one is what he deserves. Or karma namana daivanetrena. He is, according to what he deserves, he's placed in a certain position, and according to what he desires. So let us say, one has developed a taste for blood. Some have, some do have. Well, there's options. If one gets a good facility for that, one can become a tiger. If one doesn't get such good facility for it, one can become a mosquito. It's the same taste, but the facility is a little less, that's all. Yeah. And what determines the facility that we get is how much we have. We may have been materialistic, but still, have we been pious or have we been sinful? The more sinful we have been, the more we'll get a condition of suffering. The more pious we have been, the more we get a material position of enjoyment. But one who is fully attracted to the Supreme Lord and remembers him at the time of death, he will go to the spiritual world. In other traditions, they are emphasizing the point of good deeds, deeds in relation to religion and piety. Yes, such good deeds create a consciousness where one can remember the Supreme Light. So though it's leading to the same. In that way we remember the Supreme Lord. One cannot remember the Supreme Lord if one doesn't dedicate his life to him. Yeah? Not like at the end of life, last 5 minutes, now remember God, if you've never during your life remembered God. Then it's, no. One must, therefore Vedic literatures say, abhyasi yogi yuktena cheta samanya kahavina. One must practice throughout life. What happens to the soul of someone who takes their own life? This life has been given to us. We must take it as a facility given to us for learning. Some enjoyment is given to us in this life, and also suffering is given to us in this life. Sometimes we see someone who goes through a very strong dose of suffering for a prolonged period of time, and that person gets worn out by that suffering and develops a sense of mental fatigue, of no longer being able to just deal with the endless beatings. And one finds it also in Shakespeare. He describes Hamlet, who is no longer able to tolerate the burden of material life and who just desires sleep, right? Just eternal sleep. And so sometimes the person who is inclined towards suicide has the misconception that death means sleep. That's just a long sleep. No more suffering, just sleep. That's total illusion. What actually will happen is that one who is at the peak of agony and suffering and who takes his own life, that person will stay in that exact same consciousness in the body of a ghost and will have to wander around this realm much longer than he would have had to stay in the body that we have now. So in this ghost body, he has to wander around for a longer period of time, suffering the same agony that he had at the time when he took his life. So that is a punishment for that suicide. Because we have no right. Our bodies are not our property. That is where we make the first mistake. We think it's our property. It's not our property. It is the property of the Supreme Lord. And we cannot, it is meant to be used for his purpose, and not that we can just do with it as we like and dispose of it. And there's no such thing as sleep, right? Oh no, you'll be awake even at night when other people sleep. The ghosts are not sleeping. They roam about, doomed and endlessly, just on and on and on, driven along, never finding peace of mind. So good luck. So if ever the crazy thought comes in the mind, I can't take it anymore. Maybe I should just take my life. Then remember, it makes it worse. It's not at all the end. It's not at all sleep. It's like doomed to roam about for a long, long time, suffering more. So beware of such foolish ideas. Beware. Different religions believe that their own God is the right one, and they seem to quarrel with each other. Some believe in the ancestors more than God. Yes, there are all kinds of beliefs, but there are all kinds of incomplete ideas about the truth. And people are at odds with each other, and wars have been fought and whatnot. All that we can say is spirituality is manifest on different levels. On the lowest level, it is materialistic. On the lowest level, it is aimed at improving material life. That's the lowest level of spiritual life, lowest level of religion. Fix our material life. Then, in that lower region, there are categories. One is worship out of fear. Another thing is trying to connect to positive energies. So those who worship out of fear, make sacrifices or things like that, perform austerities, trying to pacify angry deities. Those who are looking for a positive material benediction are trying to attract positive influences so that their material life will improve. That's not really spiritual. That's using religion for material purpose. It's materialism. It covers materialism. Real spirituality means it's not that God works for us. Basically, in this concept, we are here in the material world, and God is meant to fix our problems. Oh God, please send me some wealth. Oh God, send me health. Oh God, send me this. Oh God, oh God, oh God, send me everything I want. Yeah? No, it's the other way around. We are created for His pleasure. So spirituality begins there, where we serve the Supreme Lord. And we say, yes, service to God. That is the higher end of religion. So wherever we find that mentality, then we end up with the higher end of religion. So yes, it's not that all spirituality is one. Eh? It's not that we are saying everybody has its own spiritual tradition and all spirituality is one. No, there are different aims, different objectives. So if your objective is I worship to get something material, then you're on the low end of religion. And you find that in every culture of the world. Let's say, in India, Indian tradition, you find rituals that are aimed at material benefit. That's the lower end of the Indian culture. In African culture, you find rituals which are aimed at material benefit. In Christian culture, we find prayers that are aimed at material benefit. But the higher end of every tradition is where we turn to God. And where we say, I am for the pleasure of Him. So that is what we are talking about. That is our interest. That is real spirituality. And therefore we say the highest level of spirituality is where we realize that we are the servant of God. And not only that, but where we realize that God is the well-wisher of all living beings, that we serve God with love, and that automatically we also serve all living beings or this creation with love. And in this way, one who is dedicated in loving service to God also becomes the loving servant of all living beings and of God's creation. Then the picture is round. And then we have religion at its peak, right? And then, yes, then gods will be all attractive. And in Sanskrit, translate that as Krishna. Thank you very much.